Who's winning the debate over pregnant capable people, and how upscale can the Democrats go? We'll discuss all this and more on this edition of The Editors. I'm Rich Lowry, and I'm joined as always by the Right Honorable Charles C.W. Cook, Madeline, Maddie Kearns, and the notorious M.B.D. Michael Brennan Doherty. You are, of course, listening to a National View podcast. Our sponsors this episode are NetChoice, Moink, and the new Brad Thor thriller, Rising Tiger. More about all of them in due course. If for some reason you're not already following us on a streaming service, you can find us everywhere from Spotify to iTunes. And if you like what you hear here, please consider giving us a glowing five-star review on iTunes. If you don't like what you hear here, please forget I said anything. So before we get into this ep in earnest, let me pause and give everyone a message from the aforementioned NetChoice. New polling shows 65% of Americans blame Biden and the Democrats for rising inflation. If they stand on a united platform to fight inflation, Republicans will likely do very well in this year's midterm elections. But some lawmakers, like Representative Ken Buck, are degrading that strategy by backing proposals which 85% of Americans believe will make inflation worse. The last thing Republicans should be doing ahead of the midterms is supporting progressive pet projects. Only 1% of voters say they want Congress to focus on tech regulation, while 60% say they want lawmakers to focus on inflation. To win in November, Republicans should listen to the people and fight back against inflationary regulations pushed by progressives. Join us in urging lawmakers to oppose Democratic pet projects like S-2992 and tell Congress to focus on the issues that matter to you. Learn more about this fight and send a letter to your representatives at netchoice.org/2992. That's netchoice.org/2992. This message brought to you, of course, by NetChoice. So MBD, big controversy this week, this horrific case in Ohio at 10-year-old girl is raped, impregnated, taken across state line into Indiana because concerns that she couldn't procure her abortion in under the new rules after the Supreme Court struck down Roe. A lot of doubt about this story. I would say there are a lot of reasonable doubts about the story. Single sourced, initially reported, I believe, by the Indianapolis Star. Glenn Kessler at the Washington Post is a very careful journalist. Wrote once or twice about it, just trying to track it down, see whether it's real, check it out, had a real hard time doing it. And a lot of people concluded from that and other indicators here that this thing was dubious or a complete fabrication. You had a lot of doubts. You didn't think it was true. Turns out to be true. What do you make of it?
Yeah, it's horrible. I expressed my doubt that the story is real in part because, you know, the Ohio policing authorities weren't saying anything about an arrest warrant or an arrest or anything. But at the same time, I opened up in my tweet saying that I doubted the story. I thought it was false. I did open up the possibility that maybe there was another story behind it, which is that we're going to find out through this case how often abortion is used to cover up and kind of keep quiet these horrifying cases of statutory rape. And that seems to be the case we're headed for now, because Telemundo yesterday kind of put a new update on the story. They found the mother of the girl, and the mother of the girl is saying that what they're saying about the alleged rapist who confessed to the crime isn't true, and that her daughter is fine, which suggests that this is one of these really ugly, heartbreaking cases where, you know, a single mother's boyfriend is the perpetrator and the single mother is in some form of denial about it. And so it's not exactly the kind of, so while the case is very real, it's not exactly a story that makes abortion look good as a sort of empowering my body, my choice thing. This is a 10-year-old girl who probably barely understands sexuality at all and probably just does not understand abortion.
It's not what we usually think of as statutory rape, right?
Right.
This is
pedophilia. So this is, you know, this kind of case is the thing that we will have to talk about as these abortion laws go into effect. Ohio's abortion law does not have a general exemption for rape for abortions after 6 weeks. It just has a kind of strongly worded exemption for the health of the mother, which I think a lot of conservatives wonder would have covered in this case, in which the Ohio Attorney General seems to believe would have made it so that this young girl could have sought an abortion in Ohio and not across state lines. But yeah, I think this is, these are the hardest of hard cases. It came up almost immediately. You know, in some ways, these are the abortions that the general public, when you poll them, they're the ones that overwhelming majorities say should be legal. So this is the tough case for pro-lifers, and we have to find a way to talk about it sensibly to people. The thing that I think is distressing in a story like this is, of course, that if not for Dobbs, we never would have heard of this case of rape, right? It just would have been...
because they would have made, gone away, the lie. So as far as we know, the doctor in Indiana, the abortionist in Indiana did report this case. She said it was the pregnancy was a result of abuse, but she said it was abuse by a 17-year-old.
Yeah, not a 27-year-old, as we found out.
Yeah, the illegal immigrant apparently has confessed is 27 years old. So you're saying this would just otherwise,
it would have disappeared. It would have been, what the phrase would have been a local crime story, right? It wouldn't have received any national attention. And, being anti-abortion, I don't believe abortion is this kind of, I don't believe if society's response to a case like this is that we've done a sufficient job responding to this young girl's needs by making abortion legal for her, I think that doesn't say something great about your society, right? If just the idea of legal abortion itself was sufficient to cover her needs, which it would have been, this story wouldn't have bubbled up without Dobbs. I don't think that that's good. I mean, in effect, what Dobbs did was shine a light into this desperate and dark situation. And it shows we have deeper problems that abortion was covering up. So, yeah, it's a really distressing case. But pro-lifers should have been ready for this. I mean, they should have the laws that were on the books waiting for Roe to fall. If Republican legislators wanted rape exceptions, they had time to write them in, but they, in some cases, they didn't.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's two things here. The first is that those of us on the Twitter sphere are very susceptible to rash judgment and the politics of I reckon this is false, I reckon this is true. It plays into our biases, whatever helps our narrative or political narrative, whatever it may be. And I think this is a case where a serious allegation was made. There was it at least been reported in one place. It was single source. It was reasonable to have a lot of skepticism about that. But there is protocol for finding out the truth. And I think if in hindsight, some people would have benefited from waiting for the facts to be established or trying to ask.
You got that MBD?
No,
that wasn't meant to be pointed, Michael.
I take the point though. I mean,
in the history of rash tweeting, it was not the worst thing, MBD, although I know you're taking a lot of hell for it. But I mean, Twitter people speculate, and all you can do is when you get stuff wrong is admit it was wrong.
Exactly. Exactly. And it's just the media environment right now is much more susceptible to that, as we saw with Covington and various other things. So it's just something to keep in mind. But of course, the allegation itself here raises so many questions. And Michael's talked about some of the questions about the mother and what was known and how did this abuse come to pass and when was it first made known to the doctor and what was the doctor told? What did the doctor report? So there's lots of questions. But I think in all of this, it's just important to think that what we're talking about here is we're talking about a child who has been incapable at every point of consenting to these things, incapable of consenting to sex, incapable of consenting to an abortion. All the decisions made for this child are being made by adults who may not have had, or certainly in the case of the rapist, but more broadly, may not have had her best interests at heart, may have had her best interests at heart, but were acting on a number of assumptions. One of those assumptions being that abortion is the least traumatizing option. Now, I can understand the argument for that. This is, as Michael says, a really, really difficult case. But there are other arguments about, you know, what could be done in that situation. And I just think this is something where the child has to come first. We have to really find out the specific details, you know, have psychologists and psychiatrists on hand to sort of evaluate the child and figure out what's going on. Certainly, I think rape exceptions as a prudential matter, as a political prudential matter, are something to consider seriously, especially given that most of the American public are uneasily pro-choice, but pretty decisively pro-choice in these cases. Now, that's quite, making a prudential political judgment is different from a moral argument, but these are really difficult cases and so worth considering.
So, Charlie, we were talking about this a little bit before we started record. I think just the rape exceptions are a political necessity. My, as we talked about, a podcast right after Dobbs came down or before, you know, I'm more a Lincolnian on these sort of questions and a Garrisonian. I just think you have to take account of the political realities and everything has to be geared. You know, we have not won this debate over abortion. Obviously, everything has to be geared to public persuasion. And the lack of exceptions just is going to, this is just the first of many cases we'll hear about like this. And it makes it really hard for the pro-life side to defend his position.
I agree with that. I'll come to that. First, I will say that I consider this a monumental crime. I don't consider it to be especially important to or informative about broader debate over abortion. This is, as Michael says, a hard case, the hardest of hard cases. It is a fringe case. This is not at root what we are debating. We are debating whether or not, in the normal course of life, women in the United States should have either a constitutional or a statutory right to abort their children. If this were the subject of our debates, they would not occupy as much space and time and emotional energy as they do. So let's not get drawn into the idea that this is why this question is so important. If you put it to almost every pro-lifer in this country that we should change the law to accommodate this circumstance, but not any others, you would have a supermajority in favor of that proposition. As such, the broader debate will continue. It is not clear to me that Ohio's law forced this girl to be taken to Indiana. Seems ambiguous. The law says that there is an exception, not in the case of rape or incest, but to prevent a serious risk of the substantial and irreversible impairment of a major bodily function of the pregnant woman. That may or may not apply. I think, as you do, Rich, that pro-lifers ought to acknowledge that while there may not be a logical or moral reason to distinguish case A from case B, we nevertheless exist in a country in which people profoundly disagree on this question and vote on the basis of this question. Sure, I would like it if we broadly agreed as a country that abortion was wrong and we're debating this sort of case, but we're not. And if pro-lifers do not make exceptions that are extremely popular rape and incest exceptions are extremely popular, then pro-lifers will lose the rest of it too. They'll lose elections. They will lose arguments. And they will not be able to limit the quotidian churn of abortion, which is their primary aim. So I am also a Lincolnian. I would remind people that the last time we had a profound disagreement as to the value of human beings in this country, it was resolved, but it was resolved by the bloodiest war in American history. It would have taken a lot longer had it not been. But I don't want to fall into the trap of extrapolating out from extremely emotive crimes and drawing conclusions about them that are then applied to a question that in the vast majority of cases do not look like that.
Yeah, it's literally an unspeakable crime. I hesitate even to read about it. It's literally an infernal crime. MBD, on this question of rape exceptions, ask a question to you. A bunch of red states have staked out a position with no exceptions except for life of the mother. That will be politically sustainable or no?
It all depends on the length of time that they allow legal abortions at the beginning of pregnancy. So Ohio is pretty tight with 6 weeks, but a lot of other states like Virginia look like they're going to 15 weeks. So yeah, it just depends on that. I actually think they will be politically sustainable, but a drag on Republicans in that, as in this case, people will travel to neighboring states.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Maddie Kearns.
Yeah, I think that as a purely prudential matter, not as a moral matter, that it makes sense to have exceptions. One thing I'm not clear about, though, is there going to be a week limit with rape exceptions? In which case, don't you just arrive at the same problem if you say, yes, in the cases of rape, but it has to be before 15 weeks. But let's say a situation like this, the 10-year-old isn't identified as being pregnant until after that point. Like, you end up in difficult mm-hmm. territory. So I don't think this is easy for Republicans either way. I don't think it's even necessarily a no-brainer, because there is in making a concession, you are sort of undermining the moral argument. Although I do broadly agree that as a matter of prudence and political strategy, that you can't start with no exceptions.
Charlie Cook.
I think that Republicans will have to remember what all political parties have to remember, and that is that there has to be some connection between public opinion and public policy. And insofar as the laws that Republicans are able to pass do that, they will thrive. And insofar as they don't, they will not. I think it's going to depend on the state we're talking about, the laws they pass, where opinion is. I think it will find an equilibrium pretty quickly.
Can I just add that we are discovering almost immediately how Europe got to where it is on these issues, which is like, if the connection is to the public opinion, a public opinion is, I don't want to talk about this. Public mm-hmm. opinion is, I don't want to hear about it. I don't want to talk about it. Maybe in the worst cases, I want it available, but I don't want abortion to be used late in pregnancy or as a kind of alternative form of contraception. And so you end up with this muddle, and then as in Europe, no one talks about it. Mm-hmm. Right? The muddle just exists. So like, it's like in this week, I think we just saw the path toward that silent, guilty muddle.
Yeah. So, it would be much better getting to a sort of Western European consensus would be much better than we were during the last 50 years of Roe, but would not be a great place for the pro-life cause in general, because so many abortions would still be legal. I love and admire all my pro-life friends. I know many of them actually lobbied to not have these exceptions in these trigger laws that have been passed. And I see the moral force in it, but I just don't think it is politically sustainable. With that, let's go to Charlie for a deeply sincere and hugely enthusiastic read from Moink.
Moink, my favorite subscription service. Because 60% of US pork production comes from one company owned by the Chinese. And their hogs are given something called ractopamine, which is banned in 160 countries, including China. Yet you find it in your grocery aisle every day. But there is a better way. I'd like to tell you about Moink. That's moo plus oink, in case you hadn't noticed. Moink delivers grass-fed and grass-finished beef and lamb, pastured pork and chicken, and sustainable wild-caught Alaskan salmon straight to your door. Moink farmers farm like our grandparents did, and as a result, Moink meat tastes like it should, because the family farm does it better. The Moink difference is a difference you can taste, and you can feel good knowing you're helping family farms stay financially independent too. You choose the meat that's delivered in every box, like ribeyes, chicken breasts, pork chops, salmon fillets, and much more. And you can cancel any time, although you, of course, will not want to. We've had a subscription now since, well, the very first time we ordered a Moink box. It is different. There's no other way of putting it. You will have to taste it to know that it's different. It won't really work if you hear me say it is, but I think Alexandra De Sanctis is a fan. I know incomparable Sarah Schutte is a fan. And this has become a monthly staple, a line item in our budget that my wife would not let me remove, even if I wanted to. But of course, I don't want to, because Moink meat just tastes different. It's absolutely delicious, which is why Shark Tank host Kevin O'Leary called Moink's bacon the best bacon he's ever tasted. And Ring doorbell founder Jamie Siminoff jumped at the chance to invest in Moink. So if you want to keep American farming going, you can do so by signing up at moinkbox.com/editors right now. And if you do, listeners of this show will get free filet mignon in every order for a year. That's 1 year of the best filet mignon you'll ever taste, but only for a limited time. If you're wondering how it's spelled, it's moinkbox.com/editors. That's moinkbox.com/editors.
Thanks so much, Charlie. So, Maddie Kearns, we had fireworks in the Senate testimony this week. This Berkeley professor, I think what she teaches is abortion and racism, basically, had this exchange with Josh Hawley when he noted that she was referring to pregnant, capable people. And Hawley is like, so do you mean women? And she said, well, women, some men can get pregnant, and trans men can get pregnant, and non-binary people can get pregnant, Senator Hawley. And I just love like how condescending, like the Senate, like this was like such a basic, like indisputable truth that she had just explained. and then went on from there, where she ended up saying that his line of questioning was transphobic. And of course it was causing harm to trans people who, you know, watching this on C-SPAN and deciding they were, you know, desperately depressed. And harm, of course, is one of the worst words now in our vocabulary. If we could go back to the old Norse and strangle this word in his crib, it would have been worth it, because it's a word that's used to intimidate and to coerce and to rule just certain ideas and expressions out of bounds, which is what this professor tried to do at the hearing. And progressives are applauding, and wow, she just shut Hawley down. But of course, 70-80 people, a percent of people, if they'd seen this exchange, would have thought she was crazy.
Yeah, I actually think it's useful as well to look at the first question she was asked, which led her to use this phrase, person with capacity for pregnancy. She was asked to acknowledge the value or claim that pro-life people make about the value of the baby. And she wouldn't acknowledge that. So she just went straight to the person, the only person who matters here is the person with capacity for pregnancy. And that was the first instance, I think, where she sort of overplayed, or pro-choicers generally overplay their hand, because most Americans are uneasily pro-choice. They at least acknowledge a conflict of rights here, and they find it difficult to get on board with late-term abortion. And that's because they acknowledge that the baby is real. The unborn occupant of the womb has some claim to life, in the way that the woman perhaps sometimes has a stronger claim, they would argue. So this is the first instance where she sort of overplayed the hand by just dismissing that outright. I think you lose people there when you do that. But then to take it a step further and to not even acknowledge women, which is what half of this debate is supposed to be about, loses even more people. And I think this is where you have this scenario of elite echo chambers, where they're totally convinced that everyone with any intelligence and any sort of moral standing totally sees this issue exactly as they do. And you just end up getting further and further away from how normal people can think of this issue and argue this issue, and into an increasingly deranged set of ideological priors. And it's incredible to see how little self-awareness they have. I mean, Megan McArdle had a great column in the Washington Post talking about exactly this, which is that most of Americans looking at this can't recognize their interests or their argument in this type of language. They know this is a woman's issue. Certainly British feminists reacting to the clip on Twitter were just outraged. These are pro-choice feminists. They were saying, why is she denying the existence of women? So I think it's rather self-defeating.
So Charlie, you posted on this, and just the illiberal presumptions undergirding her responses, which is that you got to shut up. You got to shut up, because it's just so terrible what you're doing, and it's going to literally cause people to do damage to themselves or kill themselves. So how dare you speak out loud your retrograde thoughts?
It's bullying. It's illiberal. And it should be ignored. If you're having a conversation with somebody about a public issue and they tell you that unless you agree with them, they'll kill themselves, the only correct answer is okay then. That's not how the social contract works. We cannot have a system of free and open debate and of voting if people hold themselves hostage in that sense. She didn't threaten to kill herself. She set up others as her foil. She said, I would note that this is a transphobic line of questioning. She said, I would note that 1 in 5 trans people tries suicide. Then she said, you have denied the existence of trans people if you don't believe that men can get pregnant. Then Hawley said, I don't believe men can get pregnant. She said, see, you deny the existence of trans people, which she had just told him is what causes 1 in 5 trans people to attempt suicide. The implication is obvious. It's precisely what you said. It's shut up. And the answer has to be no, I will not shut up. I thought Megan McArdle's piece on this in the Washington Post was terrific. What Megan McArdle said, in essence, is that progressives who believe that Josh Hawley lost that exchange, that Josh Hawley's position was damaged by that exchange, that Josh Hawley was owned in that exchange, to use a popular phrase, are wrong. This may have been a Rorschach test, but unlike in a typical Rorschach test, there is a right answer here. And the right answer is that Hawley and his position came off better. And that once again, only those who are already in the in-group Only those who are already susceptible to the bullying, only those who are already au fait with the neologisms and the jargon, believed that Hawley had come off poorly. This is a problem progressives have. And it is a problem that has increased in scope as the progressive takeover of institutions has progressed. Because progressives have got themselves into a position in which they talk only to people who are already on board. And when they talk to people who are not on board, they have bullied them into silence, which they take to be acquiescence.
Mm-hmm. That's their form of persuasion now. And it works, right? In the world that they usually swim in.
Right. But what Megan McArdle points out, you mentioned swimming, is that although almost nobody was prepared to say
great segue, Charlie.
Thank you. That Leah Thomas should not have been competing, the swimming association quickly changed the rules because super majorities of Americans were horrified by the spectacle of a man competing in a women's race. So it doesn't matter if you bully corporate boards or university faculty lounges or newsrooms in New York City, if out there in the real world, not just in middle America or flyover country, as it's disparagingly called, but everywhere, including among self-described liberals, many self-described progressives, there is opposition, you will lose. And Megan McArdle's point was, that's what happened here. The people who were primed to say, yes, queen, did so. And everyone else looked at that and thought, what on earth is that strange person talking about?
Mm-hmm. So MBD, I'm not a big fan of the talk about, you know, we're instantly headed to a civil war. But this is a clash of just two different worlds represented by Hawley and this professor.
Yeah, this is what distressed me about it was as soon as I saw the exchange, you know, I found myself kind of chuckling along with Senator Hawley. He was asking her questions and she was answering them. But I kind of watched it a second time and I thought, uh-oh, like actually Hawley hadn't really confronted this worldview on its own terms. And then, as everyone's pointed out, you started to see, and I started to see in my social media feeds, like my most progressive friends sharing the clip saying like, oh, Senator Hawley gets schooled and gets owned here, because it is a worldview. It's hard for people to sometimes see their own worldview for what it is. But ultimately, Hawley's worldview is that our natures are given, right? That we receive our nature. And the professor's worldview is that our identities are creations of the will, right? And that can trump nature in some fundamental way. And it's very obvious to her. And so I think in the future, if public figures, not just politicians, but any public figure wants to go after this view, we can't just ask the clever questions that kind of cause our side to chuckle. We have to begin, you know, confronting that worldview on its own terms, and whether, you know, trans-affirming care actually leads to less suicidality, or whether the way that she talks about suicides, in fact, I mean, I allege, and I believe this very strongly, I believe the professor was encouraging suicide with her talk, that she was turning it into an act of quasi-martyrdom where trans people are able to, by their suicide, kind of demonstrate the wickedness of deniers like Senator Hawley. And so in a sense, she's giving a pro-social purpose to this kind of act of despair and vengeance.
So Maddie, but before we leave this topic, I wanted to come back to you on this very question. You know, we shouldn't be dismissive of the genuine mental and psychological distress of many people with gender dysphoria. It's just this, the idea, and you know much more about this than the rest of us do, the idea that distress is exclusively and entirely caused by people, you know, doubting whether we should have transgender bathrooms or whether men should compete against women in swimming, or, you know, or the use of transphobic language, quote unquote, just seems absurd. And the pro-trans people never seem to admit that actually there's something inherent about this condition that is causing this stress or related. Yeah,
exactly. It's politically convenient to pretend that the thoughts of suicide and suicidal ideation come from the external environment. This assumption is in all of the pseudo studies that the clinical activists produce, is this idea that if there's any hint of suicidal ideation, it's because of the environment. Now, this is obviously not true, because even in places, even in cultures and environments, in families where there is very strong support of the gender transition, there is still great mental turmoil and unhappiness. A good example of this would be Jazz Jennings, the boy who was raised as a girl, had his penis inverted at age 17 on national television, and struggles with many, many mental health issues. And the assumption of the transgender activists is, if everybody in the world were celebrating transgenderism, and if everybody in the world was willing to go along with this, then this would stop. And so we have to change the world. This is not something any therapist tries or even like attempts in any other area of psychiatry. I mean, if you have gender dysphoria, something is internally going on with you. And it all often comes with various comorbidities, depression, anxiety, personality disorders, a history of trauma. These are really, really complicated things. And I think that the tendency of the left and progressives to weaponize this is exactly, as Michael says, self-fulfilling. You are encouraging a sort of emotional manipulation that is fundamentally self-destructive. I mean, every parent of teenagers has heard their teenager say in anger at some point, if you don't give me what I want, I'm going to kill myself. And the appropriate response to that is to ignore it and to make clear that's not appropriate, that that's a really outrageous thing to say and to claim, not to encourage it and to validate it. So definitely the suicide thing is one of the most despicable tactics used by trans activists.
Well, assignment desk, one of you, MBD or Maddie, should write this argument up. With that, Charlie, exit question to you. In the medium term, some sort of formulation like people with capacity to get pregnant rather than just women will be adopted uniformly, widely, narrowly by a small subset of progressives, or abandoned entirely?
It will be maintained by a small subset of progressives who, after a few years, will be marginalized by their political allies for dragging them down in the polls.
MBD.
It'll be maintained narrowly for a while until there's some watershed lawsuit by someone who's gone through transition that completely changes the conversation on it.
Many.
I think narrowly, and I think it's going to be counterproductive for those using the language, because I think already you've seen the Overton window shift, where conservatives are much more comfortable being really blunt and saying a man who says he's a woman, whereas 3 years ago, 4 years ago, people were tripping over themselves to say trans women, whatever the language was. And equally, you've seen the shift with people on the left who are now willing to say, you know, trans women and biological women aren't exactly the same. Maybe we should care about this in sports. So I think that the more they push it, the better it is for the side of sanity.
So I've tended to be very depressed about the prospects of this sort of thing and give the other side credit for just being able to force everyone to accept such ridiculous terminology, but I've been very heartened by the Latinx failure. Latinx as a term has just crashed and burned, in part through the good work of my friend Giancarlo, the Cuban Missile Sopo, who has been a terror on this issue on Twitter and elsewhere, just mocking it and pounding this Latinx thing into the ground, never to rise again. So I'm going to agree with narrowly by a small subset of progressives. With that, let's hear from our other sponsor this episode, from the number one New York Times bestselling author, Brad Thor, who pretty much we all know and love, comes a riveting new thriller, Rising Tiger. When the Chinese military launches a barbaric attack on India, America's top spy is drawn into the fray. But in the fight for democracy, who's the predator and who's the prey? Best thriller books raise that, quote, thriller fans of all stripes will devour this book. Read or listen to Rising Tiger today, available now in hardcover, ebook, and as an audiobook, read by Armin Schultz. Again, it's Rising Tiger by Brad Thor. Please check it out. So, MBD, we had a New York Times Siena poll this week, had all sorts of interesting findings in it. One of them is that Democrats now have a higher level of support among college-educated whites than they do among minority voters, very, very narrowly, but it's a tipping point, apparently the first time this has occurred. Josh Krashauer, our friend who's was at the National Journal, now at Axios, has highlighted this and kind of drove a lot of conversation about it this week. Ray Teixeira, who co-authored the book about how demographics was tipping the national electorate Democrats' way long ago, realized that actually is more complicated and there's some confounding variables here. He wrote a great piece for NR about this, and he wrote about this phenomenon of white progressives being this one reason some of the generic congressional ballot tests look a little better for Democrats. They're really into the abortion message, the gun control message, and the January 6th message, and no one else is. And as the Democrats pander more to this constituency, they're turning off even more non-college educated voters, including Hispanics. There are a lot of non-college educated Hispanics, and I'm looking at Teixeira's piece here, and he looked into the crosstabs of this echelon polling. I'll just share a couple numbers here. This just goes to the cultural divide and how this has become a big wedge between Democrats and Hispanic voters. So asked whether America's the greatest country in the world or not, by 66 to 28%, strong progressives say America is not. 70 to 23 Hispanics say it is. Is racism endemic, or is it just an individual a phenomenon of scattered haters around the country? Strong progressives, 94-6. It's endemic and systematic. Hispanics, 48-36. No, it's an individual phenomenon. Should we have looser immigration rules? Strong progressives, 97-2. Yes, we must. Hispanics divided, 44-47, and on and on. So this is not, it seemed like maybe it was a one-off, or at least progressives wanted to argue it was a one-off in Florida with Cubans and some anti-communist Latino voters going the wrong way and going with Trump. But there are indications in 2020 that this was a wider phenomenon, especially in South Texas. We've seen a confirmation of that. And this just seems to be, as Josh Krashauer said, perhaps the most important domestic political trend of our time.
Yeah, I mean, it's massive. I mean, I think in my own life, this is the biggest shift in the parties, and an observable one, right? That where, you know, Bill Clinton's first run for the White House, he absolutely slaughtered Republicans among non-college educated whites. He did really well with evangelicals too, to be honest. And that's all gone now for Democrats, and it's just getting worse. And we, you know, we should have known on election night in 2020, right? Because is the story that it's just anti-communism really plausible when the nominee for the Democratic Party was Joe Biden, right? Like, Joe Biden is not a communist, right? He's not a socialist, even if, like, some fringier figures in the Democratic Party, like AOC, have started talking about socialism positively. You know, Joe Biden's nomination was a rejection of that wing in many ways. So it's a massive shift, and I think it's a huge problem for Democrats, actually, in that the power of this class of people, right, highly educated, upwardly mobile whites, is absolutely magnified and reinforced by the dominance of that class across the media, across the non-NGO kind of sphere in the economy, and academia. So all of that, all of the pressure the media exerts on the Democratic Party is to try to push it left of where its voters are, where minority voters are, and further toward where the cultural concerns and preoccupations upwardly mobile suburban whites who are comfortable, right? Like, you see in these polls, there's this huge difference where upwardly mobile whites who are economically very comfortable are obsessed with culture war issues around trans rights and abortion. And everyone else, when you ask them what's the most important issue, you know, you're asking them. I saw one poll recently where they allowed an open response, like, what's the most important issue facing the country? And in an open response, 33% of Americans said inflation, right? That was the first thing. And that was basically not said at all by upwardly mobile white Democrats. So I think this is albatross around the neck of Democrats, and it's very hard to get out of it because, you know, previously the Democratic coalition that used to dominate American politics, especially in the House, that was when a much larger percentage of Americans were in organized labor. And organized labor provided this institution for, yes, sometimes controlling the politics of actual workers and sometimes suppressing them, but also expressing from the grassroots upward really what voters cared about and what Democratic politicians had to do to please voters who don't have a megaphone through the media otherwise. And that's gone, right? Like, organized labor in the United States is, you know, federal employees and baseball players, you know, maybe cops. And the cops and baseball players are mostly Republicans. So I think this is a massive problem, and it's only going to get worse. But it is a sign, though, that American politics is ever-changing, right? Like, this shift began in earnest in the 90s and has been accelerating ever since. And if Hispanics come into the Republican Party in very appreciable numbers, that's going to begin driving future realignments that we can't quite predict yet.
Yeah. So who's the guy, the Democratic political scientist pollster who got canceled for saying something inconvenient? And
David Shaw.
Yeah. So he made the point, MBD, to what you're saying about organized labor. You know, there was this party elite that for, you know, 50 years realized it was out of touch and realized they were different than anyone else and had a certain caution because of that. But as more and more people started going to college and it became possible more and more to live this existence where you don't encounter anyone else who, you know, doesn't at least have a college degree and multiple degrees, you could get fooled about what the country is. And that clearly has happened to a lot of Democrats. And Charlie, to this point, I mentioned our mutual friend, John Carlo, about a year ago or so, he tweeted this video that's always stuck with me. And it was a a Hispanic truck driver, and he was leaving, I don't know, Home Depot, Walmart, something where he had been buying, I don't know, with oil or something for his truck. And he had it in the shopping cart, and he was rumbling along in the parking lot to going out and his truck. And he was complaining about how expensive it was. And he's like, Joe Biden's an MNF this and MNF that. And Giancarlo's like, this is your average Hispanic voter, right? It's not someone who's going to a Latinx conference. This is the guy. And I don't think most Democrats realize that.
I think there are two things going on here. The first is that the left has got itself into the bad habit of treating Hispanics as if they weren't like everyone else, as if they were a separate bloc, as if the only people in America who really debate politics on the merits are white people. And the rest, they're groups. They're identity driven collectives. And it's not true. I think when we talked about this before, I warned Republicans against falling into the same trap and thinking, well, Hispanics are Republicans now. Probably not. What's probably happened here is that Americans generally are not pleased with the direction of the country, the state of the economy, the cost of goods, the president, the Democratic Party, and Hispanic Americans have followed suit. But there's more than that going on, at least in the short term, and this is where I think Giancarlo Sopo's work and writer Scherer's recent work matters. It is crazy to tell people that the United States is a bad country. It is crazy to expect not just people who've moved here recently, because most Hispanics haven't, but anyone who is not in the sort of rarefied, self-reinforcing elite groups that we were talking about when discussing the trans issue, that the United States of America is a bad place to live or a bad actor on the world stage or unexceptional. People just don't believe it. And there's no reason why they would believe it. You really do have to be out on a limb to have a negative view of the United States in the world and in and of itself. And you know, we spend a great deal of time now reading articles in which it is noted that Hispanics like America. You know, writer Scherer had a piece on this 2 days ago at Substack, where he said that progressive Democrats don't think that America is the greatest country in the world. You know, 27% of them do or whatever, but 70% of Hispanics do. Well, yeah, because Americans like America. It's really not an unusual thing to believe. And I think that in a sense, Republicans have lucked out, because not only do you have these headwinds running against Democrats and against their ideology, which at some point will shift against Republicans. Politics can be a pendulum. But you have one of the major parties within the United States having been captured by people who don't like the country. Now, I want to be very clear here. I am not saying that Democrats writ large do not like America. They do. I'm saying that the Democratic Party institutionally is in hock to people who don't like America, who don't think America is special, who don't think America is moral, who don't think American history is inspiring. And when you start doing that, you're going to start losing the public, and you're going to start losing subgroups within the public, of which Hispanics are one. And I think one of the reasons that it's been such a shock to the left is that if you dig down into progressive ideology especially progressive ideology that is informed by identity politics, there is an assumption that everyone except wealthy white men suffers from the American system, from the American Constitution, from the American economy. And it turns out that's actually not how a majority of voters feel. And as such, it's not how a majority of Hispanics feel either.
So, Maddie, conservatives have been worried. I've been among them for understandable reasons. You have continued high levels of immigration in a country that doesn't have a great culture of assimilation anymore. There is a worry about preserving our values. And I do think it's that concern still stands. But the people, just piling on Charlie's point, who are very most hostile to America and to our values are a subset of white people who've been here a very long time.
Yeah, I think it's one of the paradoxes of life, really, that oftentimes people who have the most reason to be grateful are the most ungrateful. This was certainly my experience at NYU and just campus culture generally, is that people who have benefited from immense privilege, both in terms of their ancestors and the social mobility that's happened throughout generations in their own families, that they've had people off the boat to, you know, coming from middle-class parents and being able to go to university, oftentimes like debt-free, arrive at college and have victim complexes. I just don't know how this happens. It's because not everybody has their values, not everybody thinks that their identity is the most important thing. This becomes their main obsession and their main way of thinking. And of course, actually, that's just not how other normal people think. I mean, it's essentially a luxury preoccupation, because if you actually have ever worried about money, if you've ever worried about practical things, your sense of self and your identity and all of this woke stuff just isn't really on your radar as much. I'm always struck with quite often Uber drivers or immigrants, and I just always find it really encouraging to have conversations with them, who oftentimes are just so grateful to be in America and think America's just the best thing.
That's a great point. Have you ever heard an Uber driver say this place sucks?
Right. No, I know I'm a different demographic of immigrant, but I certainly appreciate that and appreciate everything America has to offer. And I find it a really sort of narcissistic ingratitude that is totally out of touch with how normal people with real organic problems, and I'm not saying that it's impossible to have real problems if you're rich. It isn't, obviously, but a lot of these things are sort of self-created and much more to do with attitude. I mean, being happy and content isn't about what you have. It's about your attitude to things you already have. And if you hate your country, if you reject your inheritance, if you want to spend your time tearing things down, don't be surprised that a lot of people don't want to join you.
So MBG, I know your answer to this exit question, but I'm not going to let that stop me. Exit question to you first. This trade, upscale whites for more working class voters, especially including Hispanics, is a good trade for Republicans in your view, yes or no?
It's a good trade. The only problem I foresee is that sometimes I think Republicans are shy about actually sealing the deal, you know, getting out there and campaigning aggressively in Hispanic communities. I think the National Party could learn a lot from Florida and what was done under Jeb Bush and now Ron DeSantis, because that's how you do it.
Charlie Cook.
I think that what we are seeing is the transformation of what is really over simply described as the Hispanic voting bloc into a winnable group for either party. And I think at the moment that is hurting Democrats, because they have, in some cases, deliberately given their previous strength with white working class voters. And as such, their margins are narrow. But I have no doubt in the ability of the Republican Party to screw this up in the long run. And I suspect in 5 years, 10 years, maybe sooner, we will see polls suggesting that Hispanic voters prefer the Democrats again. What I think we are not going to see is Hispanic voters writ large voting as reliably and reflexively for Democrats in the way that, say, African American voters historically have, at least into the New Deal.
Manny Kearns.
Yeah, I agree with Charlie that it's an opportunity that could very easily be squandered. I think the difficulty with consistently attracting Hispanics is always, for Republicans, is always going to be healthcare, because the free healthcare that the Democrats offer is hard to turn down, I think.
So I think it's a very good thing. It's important for the Republicans to become robustly multi-ethnic again. Nothing will stop Democrats from accusing Republicans of being racist. In fact, given the new makeup of the Democratic Party, they'll actually be more inclined to accuse Republicans of racism. And will just, if Hispanics join the coalition in any numbers, will just say, you know, Hispanics are racist. But I still think it'd be a really good thing for the party, with the same cautionary note of from my colleagues. You know, in 08 or 12, if you'd asked this question to progressives on a podcast, was it a good trade to lose working class voters and pick up college educated voters, or the so-called coalition of the ascendant? Everyone would say, yeah, it's fantastic. But of course, it turns out the coalition of the ascendant wasn't quite what it seemed. And then also, there was an assumption that Democrats had hit bottom among working class voters under Obama when they hadn't gotten close to it. So there's a limit to how much Republicans want to lose college educated whites. But still, I'll say this is a good trade, certainly for now. And then just another indication of how God works in mysterious ways, you know, that Donald Trump gets to take some substantial credit for the overturning of Roe is incredible. And that Donald Trump somehow opened this gate to the Republican Party becoming more working class and therefore more multi-ethnic is also a great irony of our recent political history. With that, let me pause briefly, do an NR Plus plug. Digital subscription service at nationalreview.com, your way around our metered paywall, your way, if you sign up and log in, to see 90% fewer ads, your way to dig deeper into our community by commenting on articles and blog posts, by becoming part of our private Facebook group, if that floats your boat, and being invited to exclusive events and calls with various conservative newsmakers and our writers and editors. So if you're not already a member, please go today and become one. With that, let's just hit one final topic. We're just going to do it exit question style to you first. Again, MBD, Joe Manchin has been engaged in talks with Chuck Schumer about reviving some form of Build Back Better. Manchin said overnight, actually, he's not into the climate spending or the tax increases, which chops this thing down to, I don't know, there'd still be bad stuff, but 1% of what progressives wanted in dollar terms or something like that. So the exit question is, rate the heroism of Joe Manchin from 0 to 10. 0, no big deal. He represents a major Trump state. What do you expect? 10, he deserves, as Charlie said he's inclined to do before we start recording, to get a statue of him erected next to Charlie Cook's pool.
Jeez. I mean, we should just be reshaping the Jefferson part of Mount Rushmore to fit Joe Manchin's face on it. No, I'm not quite there. Like a 6. I mean, he has stood in the way, and he was also vindicated. He was concerned about inflation, and he was the only Democrat who was, and he was right to be.
Matty Kearns.
Yeah, I would give him a 6 as well. I think that's right. He's been reliable so far.
Charlie Cook.
Yeah, we can't give him any higher than a 6 because he has to finish the job. I have a piece today urging him not to go wobbly, but thus far he has made up for acquiescing to the Democrats' $2 trillion disaster last year, which is one of the main reasons we have inflation at the level we do.
That was a very bad vote.
By blocking almost everything that the party has wanted to do. If he can follow through and block the rest, then we're looking at a 9. But at the moment, it's a 6.
I go a little higher. I think it's a 7. I mean, the way it's played out has been tremendous so far. As we talked for a long time, I never had any faith in Joe Manchin. I was wrong. So far, he's just been extraordinary. And even if he gives here at the end, which I hope he doesn't, it is so much smaller and less harmful than it was at the beginning. I think just even for that, we should be grateful. So I'm a little higher than you guys. I would say a 7. With that, let's hit a few other things before we go. Maddie Kearns, you took a deep trip into rustic, rural, bucolic America and visited Ryan Anderson's farm.
Yeah, that's right. So my fiance and I were invited there for dinner.
Wait a minute, what did you say? You're what? You're what?
See, I thought I could just slip that in there without making a big fuss of it. But we went there for dinner and it was really nice. And Mrs. Anderson made a wonderful dinner. Ryan had joked that he was going to slaughter an animal right before us, because I don't know if you follow Ryan on Twitter, he's it's pretty old school the way they go about things on that farm. So but it was delicious and really nice, rustic.
The slaughtered animal was delicious.
The slaughtered animal was delicious. I think it was from their neighbor's farm. So I don't think Mrs. Anderson had actually slaughtered it herself. I've told reliably that she is the chief slaughterer of the family.
MBD, you found a rare record you've been looking for.
Yeah, I'm not much of a collector of any items or rarities, but as dedicated listeners know, I'm a huge fan of the 90s rock group Ben Folds 5. I did a podcast with Political Beats about them. And I finally found after about 15 years looking for a good version of it, a 7-inch vinyl single that they produced themselves before they were signed to a record deal, which they seem to have photocopied the cover art on, and it's their first single, Jackson Cannery, with the B-side Eddie Walker, and that completes my vinyl collection of Ben Folds 5, so I'm pretty pleased about that.
Charlie Cook?
I'm watching Ken Burns' Civil War documentary.
Finally?
Finally.
Shelby Foote?
This is like a Zan level light item.
Well, I think Zan had this light item a while back.
Yeah, I'm vaguely remembering that. Are you enjoying it?
I am. It's absolutely remarkable. It's a triumph. It's been remastered, so it looks good on modern televisions.
So I've been going through a little phase here of listening to the Rolling Stones song, You Can't Always Get What You Want, in part prompted by the hilarious scene in the new Minions movie near the end, where there's a funeral where the Minions are singing a version of this song. And it's just a wonderful song. I'm not a huge Rolling Stones guy, but Charlie, true or false, snap exit question just to you. It is the best Rolling Stones song, yes or no?
No, it's not.
What?
The best Rolling Stones song is the song they don't play anymore because it is unwoke. Quite legitimately unwoke if you listen closely to it. The best Rolling Stones song is
Brown
Sugar. Or actually, I think now you've asked, I think Gimme Shelter is the best Rolling Stones song.
Mm. Do you, as a Beatles guy, do you share John Lennon's dim view of the Rolling Stones, that they're just copying Beatles stuff, and this You Can't Always Get What You Want was just to follow on from, they got the idea from Hey Jude?
Well, they did get the idea from Hey Jude, and they did copy the Beatles. And around that period, they were envious of the Beatles, which is why they put out that album On Her Majesty's Satanic Request, which is a sort of facsimile of Sgt. Pepper. I like the Rolling Stones a great deal. I just don't think the Rolling Stones are in the same league as the Beatles. And that's not to criticize the Rolling Stones, it's to elevate the Beatles.
Yeah, but Taylor Swift is.
Better than the Beatles, no doubt.
Absolutely. All right.
Well, so, she did it all on her own, you see. Whereas there were four of them.
So it's that time in the podcast for our editor's picks. MBD, what's your pick?
My pick is Kyle Smith's Hang in There, Joe Biden, which I think was a response to a piece by you, Rich. But it was just Kyle at his best. And I think I'm going to keep picking Kyle until there's no more Kyle left to pick.
There's a, so yeah, so that raises the sad news that Kyle Smith is leaving National Review to become the movie reviewer for the Wall Street Journal, a dream job for Kyle. Hopefully he'll do it for the next 30 years and he'll of course be wonderful at it, but a great boon to the journal and a loss for us.
Yeah, but this is just classic Kyle. It's funny, hilarious, and mocking.
Maddie Kearns, what's your pick?
My pick is Dan McLaughlin's defense of Amy Coney Barrett, entitled Slate's Sleazy Claim That Amy Coney Barrett Isn't As Smart As Her Male Colleagues. I think this is a point that conservatives just need to keep making, is the complete double standard when it comes to the way that women are talked about or criticized. If it's a conservative woman, all the so-called feminist principles just go right out the window. And this is a very good illustration of that. And well done by Dan.
Charlie Cook, what's your pick?
My pick is Ed Whalen's magazine piece titled Servants of the Constitution, which is about how we got from Roe v. Wade to the overturning of Roe v. Wade.
So my pick is a Kevin Williamson piece titled Of Latinos and Hispanics and Tejanos, getting into this issue we were just discussing, that there's really no Latino bloc. And Kevin has thought about this a lot and cues into the subtleties here. And it's just a wonderful bit of writing, of course. So that is it for us. You've been listening to a National Review podcast and your rebroadcast, retransmission, or count this game without the express written permission of National Review Magazine is strictly prohibited. Thank you, Charlie. Thank you, Maddie. Thank you, MBD. Thanks to NetChoice, Moink, and Rising Tiger. And thanks especially to all of you for listening. We are the editors, and I saw her today at the reception. A glass of wine in her hand. All right, enough of that. We'll see you guys next time.